All righty, everybody, welcome. And on behalf of the Shoreline City Council and staff, I want to thank you for participating this evening in the second speaker series, of the speaker series of 2012 with the comprehensive updating. I am reading this thing and I can't even read it. For the speaker series for the updating of the comprehensive plan. Throughout 2012, the city will be embarking on setting goals and creating policies that are specifically intended to support the realization of Shoreline's 20-year vision, Vision 2029. Over the next 4 months, the city will be sponsoring a series of speakers who will present them themes related to the comprehensive plan. Speakers will be giving presentations on topics related to the components of the plan that will be discussed by the Planning Commission the following week. The speaker series will bring enlightening and inspiring speakers to Shoreline with hopes of growing ideas within the community that will lead to actualizing Vision 2029. These presentations are intended to be thought-provoking and do not necessarily reflect any adopted city policy. Following tonight's presentation, you'll be invited to stick around and share your ideas with staff and each other. We're particularly interested in hearing your ideas regarding future station area planning and components of transit-oriented development that you think would be appropriate or maybe even think would be inappropriate for the city of Shoreline. My scrolling is going slow. Your ideas will be transformed into new goals and policies to guide the station area planning and to inform elements of the comprehensive plan, which will help guide future decisions made by the city officials and staff. Now, before I introduce tonight's speaker, we want to show a short video to help frame goals for the speaker series. So I think at this time, we're going to show that video. You want us all to gather around that screen?
It's a great video if you guys could see it.
In the fall of 2008, the city of Shoreline began.
In
the fall of 2008, the city of Shoreline began working with the community to create a Shoreline vision for the next 20 years. More than 300 people participated in the process, generating over 2,500 individual comments. With our community's input, the council adopted Shoreline's Vision 2029 statement in May of 2009 and incorporated it into the city's comprehensive plan, the blueprint for Shoreline's future. What will Shoreline's future look like?
Shoreline in 2029 is a thriving, friendly city where people of all ages, cultures, and economic backgrounds love to live, work, and play.
Shoreline is a regional and national leader for living sustainably.
The city has several vibrant neighborhood main streets that feature a diverse array of shops, restaurants, and services.
Shoreline continues to be known for its outstanding schools, parks, and youth services.
Shoreline's neighborhoods are attractive, friendly, safe places to live. The city's real strengths lie in the diversity, talents, and character of its people.
Neighborhood Main Streets serve as transportation hubs, with public transit providing quick connections to downtown, the University of Washington, light rail, and other regional destinations.
Shoreline is recognized as a business-friendly city, with many small businesses and larger employers providing the services residents need and attracting workers from throughout the region.
The improvements put in place in the early decades of the 21st century have made Aurora an attractive and energetic district with a variety of businesses, shops, eateries, and entertainment.
The city's commitment to community health and welfare is reflected in the rich network of programs and organizations that provide human services throughout the city to address the needs of all its residents.
The people of Shoreline are committed to making the city even better for the next generation.
This is Shoreline's vision. The question now is, how do we make it a reality? Over the coming months, the city will be setting goals and creating policies that are specifically intended to support the realization of this vision of Shoreline by 2029. We need you to be a part of this process. Shoreline can achieve this vision through the dedication and hard work of residents being involved in planning our community's future.
Shoreline.
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 You shared your vision. Now, let's create our future.
Oh, I thought you were starting again. I thought we were going to see it a second time. All right, thank you. Before I go any further, I did want to recognize we have Council Member Hall with us tonight in the room, too. So if you can raise his hand there so we know he's there. All righty. Now the introduction. Sarah Schott Nikolic is a senior planner with Growing Transit Communities, a new effort at the Puget Sound Regional Council to create equitable opportunities for people to live and work in or near high-capacity transit in Puget Sound region. She is the lead staff for the North Corridor planning effort encompassing the long-range high-capacity transit corridor from downtown Seattle to Everett, including transit nodes on Aurora Avenue and I-5 and Shoreline. She created and led the Transit-Oriented Communities Program at the statewide nonprofit FutureWise, and was the lead author on the comprehensive 2009 publication Transit-Oriented Communities, a Blueprint for Washington State. Her articles on transit-oriented development have appeared in numerous journals and blogs, including the recent Growing Equitable Transit Communities in the winter 2012 issue of AIA Seattle Forum. Sarah is a native of Chicago, but she's been a lifetime and has been a lifetime transit commuter, and she enjoys her walkable neighborhood in North Seattle, and she's been there since 2005. So if you would please help me welcome Sarah Schott Nikolic.
Thank you. So this is on, and I apologize that I even have to use this, especially with a crowd like this. I wish we could all just kind of huddle around and have a conversation, but because I'm being taped, they insisted on that I use this microphone, so I'm going to go ahead and do it. Thank you for that introduction, and I want to talk a little bit about the presentation today. What I've been asked to talk about is transit-oriented development, which is actually an absolutely horrible term, and we're going to talk a little bit about why it's so horrible, but I've spent the last 6 years working almost exclusively on transit-oriented development issues, so I know a lot about the ideas and the values and the hopes and the dreams behind the term, and that's really what I want to talk about tonight, and really what we feel at the Growing Transit Communities Partnership at the Puget Sound Regional Council is that what we're really trying to do is grow equitable transit communities, and so I want to talk a little bit about what that means. So tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about not what is transit-oriented development, but what are equitable transit communities. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about the specific new effort that was mentioned, the Growing Transit Communities Partnership at the Puget Sound Regional Council that I'm fortunate to be working with, and then finally wrap up by talking a little bit about how we can plan for equitable transit communities here in Shoreline. So a little bit about me. I don't really need to say anything because you just heard a little bit about me, but I've been working in this field for a while in the public sector right now, previously in the nonprofit advocacy sector, working almost exclusively on these transit-oriented community issues that we'll be talking about tonight. But I think what's more important than just the credentials or the articles or anything else like that is that I'm a person. I walk. I take a bus. I take a train sometimes. I've got two kids. I care about the quality of the schools. I care about the safety of my neighborhood, of the sidewalks, and that really I'm a person. I'm a person that lives in a city, that lives in a region that is growing, and I care about the future of that region. I care about the future for myself, for the people that live in my neighborhood, for the people that live in my region, for my kids, and share really, I think, a lot of the hopes that probably a lot of you in the room share for what this region could be, what the cities in the region could be. But what I'm really interested in is first learning a little bit more about you. So if I can throw some questions out, if you can humor me with this a little bit. So how many of you live in Shoreline? Anyone not live in Shoreline? Couple people. Okay. And do you think you will always live in Shoreline? Who thinks they will always live in, hopes to always live in Shoreline? So some people. Do you think there will always be a place for you to live in Shoreline? Couple people. Okay. Let's see. What else? Who works for the city of Shoreline? Who works in the public sector? A couple people. Who is here as a citizen interested in the future of Shoreline? Who's here as a planning commissioner? Who's here as an elected official? Got a couple, okay. Who here has a vision of growth for Shoreline? What does that mean? Who here thinks that growth is a good thing? Who here thinks growth is a scary thing? What are some things that you associate with growth? More congestion. So cars, you're talking mostly cars. What else? Population density. So and density is a lot of people, but is there something good or bad that comes along with that you're thinking about?
Can't move around as well.
Can't move around as well, okay.
Density has benefits.
But density has benefits, and I'm going to come back to you.
Just change.
Yeah. It's different from how it's been. It's different from, and how many of you have lived in Shoreline for more than 5 years? More than 10 years? All your life? A handful. But, you know, I've lived in this region for 6 years now, and it is my home, and I love it here. And I know that you can get, you know, that when you have roots, when you are in a place, when it is your home, you care about it. And you care about what happens to it. And change can be a daunting and scary thing. But it can be a real opportunity, and it can be an exciting opportunity. And I think that the communities that are proactive about change, that get out ahead of change and shape that change, are communities that are really able to reap the benefits and reap the rewards that change can sometimes bring. So it's with that spirit that I want to talk a little bit tonight about that I've been asked to talk about? Transit-oriented development. Such a horrible thing. So transit-oriented development, what do you think about when you hear transit-oriented development? Has anyone heard that phrase before? A couple of you? What do you think about? Don't raise your hands. Just yell things out.
If there's a bus line, maybe there'd be development.
Development. Yeah, that word's right in there. Development.
Businesses.
Big buildings. Big buildings.
Opportunity to live car-free.
But I've heard big buildings, I heard new businesses, rapid transit, yeah, transit's in there too. So, you know, there's been a lot of buzz about transit-oriented development, TOD. It's been this very amazingly strong, effective branding that has happened in the real estate world. It's the emerging trend is, you know, get on top of TOD and you're going to make a lot of money and you're going to build tall buildings. And what we've seen in the city of Seattle in particular, in neighborhoods that are experiencing change as rapid transit has arrived with Link Light Rail, is that transit-oriented development means development. It means tall buildings. It means people from the outside coming in with their cars. And it's kind of, you know, the word development is right in there. And really what we're talking about is we're talking about growth. We're talking about, at the core, we're not talking about planning for buildings. We're not talking about planning for new sidewalks or new roads even. We're talking about planning for people. And what is happening is that this region is growing. The city of Shoreline is going to grow. Every city in this region is going to grow. And at the core of it, we are not growing. We don't have numbers of how many buildings we have to build, how many offices we have to build. We have numbers of how many people we're expecting to accommodate, how many people we're expecting to embrace and make a part of our community. And I think what can really be helpful sometimes when we're experiencing change is to personalize that growth a little bit. So when I talk about growth, when I think about growth, when I think about how my neighborhood might grow in the future, I think about the fact that I'm out here in Seattle. My parents are retiring now and would love to live closer to their grandkids. This is a really expensive region for them to retire to. So is there, you know, and they're going to be on fixed incomes. They're going to be, at some point, be transit dependent. Is there a place for them to come here? So that's part of the growth. Part of the growth is my sister, who's single, who if she moves out here, and she is not a six-figure type person, you know, she's going to need a place to live. She doesn't think she could afford to live here. So that's part of the growth. Part of the growth are my kids. My kids are 5 and 7 right now, but in our planning horizon by 2029, they're going to be grown-ups, and they're going to need a place to live, and they're not going to be, you know, they're, so that's the growth. The growth is the people that you know. The growth is you. Where are you going to live in 10 years? Where are you going to live in 20 years? Where are you going to live if you are ever on a fixed income, if you are ever transit dependent? Is there a place for you to live? So thinking about growth in those terms, thinking about personalizing it in those terms, it's easy to start thinking about this in terms of communities instead of development. So what we are talking about in the Growing Transit Communities work that I'll be discussing tonight is really the idea of growing equitable transit communities. And we threw the word oriented out too, because who says it has to be oriented around the transit? Yes, it's going to be close to the transit, but it's oriented around people. And people, that might be, yeah, that might be the train, it might be a community center, it might be a church, it might be a grocery store, it might be a cafe, you know, but the what it is that makes a place is going to be different from one place to another. So, and that's what really orients a community. So got rid of that word. We're really talking about equitable transit communities, and I'll get to the equitable part here in a second. So Vision 2040, which was originally adopted in the 1990s, is as Vision 2020 at the time, is for the 4-county region. This is our growth strategy for the region. It was updated through a 3-year process from 2005 to 2008, looking out to 2040 and the 1.7 million people that are expected to come to our 4-county region in that time, and 1.3 million jobs during that time. So that's a huge amount of growth. That's another, you know, the equivalent of more than three Seattles. The population of Seattle coming to our region in that a little more than 30-year period. Now, the development patterns goal. Now, this was a 3-year process. They talked with tons of people throughout the region, and this was adopted by the regional council, which are made up of the elected officials throughout the region. The overarching goal of the development patterns chapter of Vision 2040 states that the region will focus growth within already urbanized areas to create walkable, compact, transit-oriented communities that maintain local character. So again, this is adopted regional policy, and this was before light rail even opened. This was really thinking forward to the transit investments that we're making in our region. How can we encourage people? How can we give people more chances to live and work close to these transit investments, not only to maximize ridership and leverage this investment that we've made, but also to create great, vibrant places, great communities, and to make it easier for people to move throughout the region, to access their jobs, to access services, to get to destinations, to move about and live their lives. And so, you know, at the core, this idea of equitable transit communities, this is a chart. It's kind of hard to read because there's tiny fonts up there. But if you look up TOD or any of the other acronyms that are related to TOD, you're going to come up with, you'll be able to find 100 different schematic ideas of what a TOD is or what an equitable transit communities is that we're talking about. And at the core, yeah, I'll talk about the three little circles over there and the words that are in there. But at the core, it's a great place. So what makes a great place? What do you love about the places that you live in?
Peace.
Peace meaning the quiet? Quiet. Lack of warfare in your...
Sure.
Okay.
Safe.
Okay, safety's huge. Smallness. Okay, smallness of the community. Okay. Compared to Seattle.
Yeah.
Yeah, walking to services or even just being able to access services. So it might be walking, might be biking, might be taking a bus, might be taking your car. But it's the point of having a grocery store that is within a reasonable distance of your home. You know, being able to go to dry cleaning, being able to find childcare, being able to get your kids to school. It's having all of those different elements together in one place that make living successful for you. And without those different elements, places are less livable, places are less peaceful, places are less accessible, and it's harder to get around. And when you have other challenges in your life, and we'll get to the various populations that might have some of those challenges, if you're transit dependent, if you are on a fixed income, it can be really hard to get around if those pieces aren't there in your community. So the way we're conceptualizing equitable transit communities right now, and this is a work in progress, is that equitable components of equitable transit communities, that outcomes that we want to see in these neighborhoods are mobility. And that means people of all ages, of all abilities, are able to move around. They're able to move around by transit, by walking, by biking, by taking a car, that if there are any special needs, that those special needs are met as well. That they have access. And access doesn't just mean, you know, the ability to walk through a door into a building, although certainly having the right types of services available is important, like the grocery stores and the various amenities. That's important, but it's also about having access to opportunity, so having the opportunity to live in a place, so having housing opportunities, having employment opportunities, having those services, having education opportunities, having training opportunities, and having opportunities for civic engagement. So whether that's through a political process in a city, or whether that's having opportunities for civic engagement in your community and in your neighborhood, these are important pieces of being in a livable community. And then finally, this kind of catch-all category of livability that captures some of those other pieces, like safety, the safety of a community, the lighting, the sense of security that you have, the public health issues, so the air quality, the sidewalks, so that you can have an opportunity for active living, for recreation, the amenities, and then the design of the buildings, the design of the houses, and the more that kind of aesthetic, pleasing design, so that you feel a sense of place and a sense of character. So these are the components of equitable transit communities, and the equitable piece comes in that we're thinking about how do we make these types of communities throughout Central Puget Sound, especially around our transit investments, and make them available to people throughout the region, make them available to the people that live here now, and especially make them available to the people that are growing up here now, that are going to live here, that would like to have a chance, or I'm sure they're parents, speaking as one, would like to have a chance for their kids to stay here, but also the people that will be coming into the region because of the job growth that we're expecting and because of the economic development that we have going on in this region still. So how do we think forwardly about the needs of those people, the needs of our children, the needs of the future generations, and make sure that we are providing equitable access to these types of communities throughout our region? And so these livability principles I'm going to go through real quickly, and these are the principles that we're using in the program, and that they echo what you've already talked about in the vision for the sustainability strategy here in Shoreline and in the vision statement for the comprehensive plan update. And there are these basic tenets that I think most people understand and agree with, giving transportation choices. So, you know, having the opportunity to walk or to bike or to take transit, having the opportunity to take your car. This is still about, you know, having choices, not limiting choices. This is about increasing access, increasing mobility. Promoting equitable, affordable housing. So this is looking at, you know, where are you going to live in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years? Where are your kids going to live? Where are your siblings going to live? It's about thinking about the demographic changes that are happening not only in Shoreline but in the whole region, the different types of households that we're seeing, and I'll talk about some census data here in a little bit. It's thinking about what are going to be the needs of those populations, and are we providing equitable access to housing? Are we providing housing that's affordable to the range of incomes that we're expecting in our region? Here in our communities. It's about enhancing economic competitiveness. This is huge, and I'll talk about this in a little bit as well, in greater detail as well. But having these types of neighborhoods, these types of communities, has led businesses to locate in our region. It is a tremendous asset that the region has to have these types of neighborhoods. It's a battle that we see happening between the cities on either side of the lake all the time, of people working on one side but living on the other because of the neighborhoods that they like to live in, but the jobs are over there. So it's about trying to create more of these neighborhoods throughout the region, and more jobs around the region as well, so that people have the opportunity to live and work close together. Supporting existing communities. This is really important as well, is that this is not about whole cloth just trying to wipe aside current development patterns or current communities. This is about looking at ways that we can enhance certain neighborhoods, that we can strategically put growth in certain neighborhoods where it makes sense. It's about trying to mass growth in a way that is amenable and makes sense and hopefully strengthens and fosters the sense of community in these existing communities. So it's important that this is not about rezoning the entire region. This is about being strategic about where we put growth and making sure that it's done in a way that's thoughtful and forward-thinking. Coordinating policies, leveraging investments. Again, this is about, you look at the light rail investment. This is a multi-billion dollar investment that every taxpayer in the region is shouldering. And so what are we doing to make sure that we are leveraging that investment to maximize its benefits to all of us, to decrease congestion, to provide more transportation choices for people throughout the region, to increase mobility? What are we doing to maximize that investment that we are all making? And this is a key strategy to encourage people or to allow people to live close to these transit investments. And then finally, valuing communities and neighborhoods. And this really gets at the public planning process and making sure that we have meaningful engagement from a whole, just the whole gamut of communities that are in our region that live close to these transit investments now. So on that, this idea of equitable planning and how do we, who is included, who's at the table, how do we make sure that we're not just having people at the table, but that it's meaningful. It's important that we include the perspective of affected communities, so certainly the neighborhoods. And just out of curiosity, does anyone live within walking distance, by walking distance, let's say a half mile of a planned bus rapid transit on 99 here, so rapid ride. Does anyone live on Aurora? No. Okay. So, but within a half mile, so potentially walking distance of rapid ride. Does anyone live within walking distance or a half mile of any of the possible light rail stations on I-5? So, got a handful, a couple people as well. So, it's very important that the communities that are going to receive this transit investment, that are going to experience a lot of change as a result and a lot of the benefits, but also a lot of the change and newness that comes with these transit investments, are at the table and are included. It's also really important, and this has been a real challenge in our region, to include the perspectives of populations that have been underrepresented in the past. And this is particularly the case in when we look at the 99 corridor going north from Shoreline up to Everett, we look at the very large number of immigrant communities that have been coming into the region in the last 10 years, and that is a growing portion of our population. How do we make sure that we are planning for their needs? How do we make sure that they are at the table when there are real language barriers, when there might be cultural barriers to having them at the table? And so it requires having some innovative strategies for outreach. It requires making extra effort to think about the needs of those populations in the future as those populations grow in our communities. And then it's about thinking about future residents. And this is really one of the hardest things too, because when you get a group of people around the table to plan for a community, you're going to have the people that live in the community. Who represents the voice of someone that might live there 20 years from now? Maybe isn't even born yet. So they're not sitting at the table. So it's, it requires that the decision makers and that the community members are thinking about the needs of future residents as well. And that can be a real intangible thing because you never quite know what that looks like. But it's about looking at market analyses of growth, 20 years out, 30 years out, 40 years out, and anticipating some of those needs, doing some of that needs analysis to make sure that you're thinking about the needs of the diverse, potentially very diverse needs when it comes comes to income or culture, a variety of factors of those future populations. So when you do all of this, when you have these equitable transit communities that have the mobility and the livability and the access, and when you've done the planning process and you've included everyone, there's a whole just a lot of data, a whole lot of data from the international level, looking international level all the way down to the very, very local level that says when you do this right, when you have all of these pieces that come together, you can really just reap tremendous benefits to yourselves as individuals, to your community, to your city, and to the region. And just, I'm not going to belabor these too many, but to go through them just very, very quickly, you know, these walkable communities are it's been very well established now that that they promote a more active lifestyle, that this is very important to public health. When you look at the research that's been done, particularly on the aging community, that having sidewalks, having access to regular exercise, even if it's just walking to and from the bus, walking to and from the grocery store, taking a walk around your block, this is really important as our community is getting older and as we see the increased incidence of obesity rates, of child obesity, of type 2 diabetes. This is a really critical thing moving forward from a public health standpoint. And then, you know, cuts air pollution, reduces motor vehicle accidents, because giving other options besides driving. But on the community side, social benefits, you know, there has been just a huge nationwide, but particularly in the Seattle region, a push for more walkable communities. And we're seeing the price index for housing in walkable communities. You know, this walk score, who has seen walk score? Who knows the walk? Yeah, so this walk score, you can go to walkscore.com, I think. But even now, all of the real estate listings will often list what the walk score of that house is. And it tells you, you know, can you walk to a movie theater? Can you walk to a cafe? Can you walk to a restaurant? Can you walk to get groceries? Can you walk to transit? And it spits out a score at the end and decides whether or not that house is a walker's paradise or, you know, a walker's not paradise. And so this market demand for walkable communities has been huge. And these types of developments, these types of neighborhoods are helping meet that demand. And that's really what we're seeing in a lot of communities in the central Puget Sound region, particularly as the next generation is coming up and graduating and looking for their first job. This is really important to that generation. And so having these types of neighborhoods is a way to keep your youth close to you. So for those that's important to. Evidence also strengthening that sense of place, decreasing isolation, more opportunities to see people on the street, say hi to your neighbors, increases opportunity for civic engagement. Environmental benefits, very, very well-established linkage between these types of development, you know, where more people are living and working close to transit with sidewalks, all of these amenities, between that and lowering vehicle miles traveled. There's lots of evidence that says when given the option, when people have choices, they tend to drive less. And that reduces, you know, particularly in central Puget Sound, very important, our transportation-related carbon emissions is over half of our carbon emissions regime here in central Washington. So, you know, this is a really, central Puget Sound, rather. So this is really important. And then also, when you have more compact housing, particularly multifamily housing, there's an opportunity for considerable energy conservation as well. From the built environment. And then finally, land conservation, improving water quality, protecting wildlife habitat, preserving rural and resource lands. Again, this is when we encourage growth in our cities, in our existing urban areas, as opposed to the urban fringe areas where we're eating up farmland and resource lands and wildlife habitat. And then finally, economic benefits. On the individual level, it decreases transportation-related costs. This isn't the case in Shoreline, but in other areas in King County, people are paying more in transportation out of their annual household expenses, more in transportation annually than they are in housing costs, where you're seeing, you know, 30-35% of their annual income is going towards transportation. And so when you have the opportunity to make shorter trips with your car or make some trips without your car, it's going to reduce that transportation-related burden on your household. So doing that, and then, of course, increasing access to jobs, and then more broadly thinking more about societal impacts. It's maximizing our investments. It's using land and resources more efficiently, and again, keeping our region economically competitive. And that's what we're seeing as we have businesses that are relocating to our region. It's because their employees are going to want to live here because of the neighborhoods that we have. So how do we plan for equitable transit communities? And this is important because planning happens at so many different levels and just really encompass such an array of issues. And so this diagram shows four different levels that it happens at. You can plan for this type of growth, this type of development at the parcel level, the very site-specific level. You can plan for it at the station area level, which is often done by drawing a radius around a high-capacity transit station and planning in that half-mile radius area or sub-area. You can plan at the corridor level, which is what the work I'm leading is doing. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about that. And the corridor level is looking at a whole series of station areas along a single transit corridor. And then you look at the region level, and that's what the Puget Sound Regional Council has been doing or has already done and continues to do through their updates to the Vision 2040 plan. But it's important that planning, this type of planning for equitable transit communities encompasses a whole array of issues. It's not just land use. It's not just zoning. It's not just building height and density. It is about community development. It is about the social services. It is about transportation. It is about housing affordability. It's about providing jobs close to housing. It's about just, you know, this whole, you know, street lighting and design and schools. And, you know, it's all of these little pieces that make up a great community. That's what this planning needs to include. And then finally, it includes that broad spectrum of stakeholders that we talked about before. So the current residents, the future residents, the underserved or underrepresented populations. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the Growing Transit Communities partnership that I'm involved in. And this is a regional effort, but the reason that I think it's really important for you to know about it is one, there are five study areas in the city of Shoreline that are part of our effort. But two, we're going to be collecting a lot of data over the course of the next year. We're going to have a lot of recommendations that we feel will help bring value or help bring resources to the city of Shoreline as you move forward with your comprehensive plan update. So real quickly, the big picture is that at the federal level a couple years ago, a bunch of agencies, it was the EPA and U.S. Department of Transportation and U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development was the main one, HUD, got together and realized, you know, we've all been doling out money for all these years to these local efforts, and we don't really talk to each other, and we don't really have the same priorities, and maybe it'd be good if we talk to each other. Maybe it'd be good if we actually are strategic and work together and try to fund things in alignment with each other. And so these three agencies forged the Partnership for Sustainable Communities that was really based upon those livability principles that I talked about before with the transportation choices and housing choices and all of that, and said, you know, the three of us are going to work together to try to align our investments in local communities to support these types of places and these types of regions and communities that are planning for these types of places. And so one of the first things that they did, our good federal government does, is offered a grant program. And they issued an RFP and said, you know, any region out there that's planning to think about these types of sustainable communities, let us know, and we'll give you up to $5 million to work on it. At which point we said, ooh, us, pick us, please. We worked for about a year, brought together a number of stakeholders, and really saw this as an opportunity to implement a lot of the work that had already happened in our region. We already had a long-range planning document, Vision 2040, that said a lot of the same stuff that the feds were saying about livability and about sustainability. It was what we wanted for our region anyway. We already had a transportation plan that had over a lot of money in transit investments that we were already planning. We'd already passed this huge initiative in 2008 to extend light rail throughout the region. You know, we were already doing a lot of these things. We had an economic strategy in place, and so we saw this as an opportunity to bring some planning money to the state to really work on implementing these, to create the roadmap, to create the tools so that we could make these visions a reality. And so got a whole big group of people together. Don't try to read that slide. It just lists all of the partners that we have to date. Originally, it was about 18 partners that put the grant together. Now we're up to almost 40. But the point is that it was a big tent. We had public sector there. We have a bunch of cities there. City of Shoreline's not there. It'd be great if you were. City of Shoreline is welcome to join this big tent at any point, and encourage you to do so. But we have a number of cities in the region, the counties. We have transit agencies, public health, public housing. We have funding institutions. We have nonprofit developers and for-profit developers. We have regional groups that look at a whole host of different issues. We've got educational institutions. We've got the enviros there. We've got housing and community advocates. And we've got a joinability clause that says, come and join us. We want more cities. We want more perspectives. We want you at the table. We want you a part of this effort. And really, what this effort was about is, you know, let's think about this long-range investment that we're making in high-capacity transit and rapid transit. And by long-range, I mean what we have in Transportation 2040, our long-range transportation plan that has identified three long-range transit corridors. One is from Seattle all the way to Everett. One's from Seattle to downtown Redmond. One's from Seattle to downtown Tacoma. It's not all funded yet. Light rail is only going to Linwood right now. But at some point, that's the vision is that we're going to extend it. And so this group came together and said, you know, how can we encourage the community development in all of these cities? How can we encourage, how can we maximize this investment and create great places along the way while accommodating the growth that we're expecting in the region and while bringing economic competitiveness and more jobs and more livability to all of our cities along these transit routes? And so that was sort of the vision when we came together. And looking at the North Corridor here, North Corridor here extends from Seattle all the way up to Everett. And along the way, of course, we know there are certain light rail stations that have been defined in the city of Seattle. We know where they are. And then we get to Shoreline here from Northgate, and we had a couple alternatives that were being considered, and now it's just an I-5 alignment that's being considered. But because the 99 alignment was still being considered when we started this process, and because the 99, those communities along 99 are along such a tremendous investment that the city of Shoreline has made in the Aurora Corridor project, and because there is such a tremendous investment happening there with the Rapid Ride program that King County Metro is undertaking, we decided as a organization, as an effort, that we would continue looking at those and continue thinking about how can we make these are important to the city of Shoreline, these are important to the region as well. They're not going to have light rail, but they're still important places, and so let's include them in our consideration. And then just so that you know, I'm not going to talk too much north of Linwood, but the light rail line, of course, was funded to Linwood Transit Center, which is right there. And then north of that, who knows where it's going to go? Someday it's going to be there's going to be another ballot initiative, and we're going to talk about extending light rail up to Everett, but we don't know where it's going to go. And that work is years ahead. But we do know that there are a lot of really important activity nodes up there now, which might be places of residential density. It might be places where there are a lot of jobs, like Boeing. It might be places where there have already been transit investments along the Swift Corridor on Evergreen Way. And those are important places, whether light rail gets there in 10 years or 20 years or 40 years. They're important places to the region and to this whole corridor today. And so we want to focus on, you know, how can we encourage the right type of redevelopment, the right type of community development in those areas. So the partnership, the Growing Transit Communities Partnership, is really made up of four components, and I'll talk about each one of them briefly. The Corridor Action Strategies, the Regional Equity Network, the Affordable Housing Strategy, and Demonstration Projects. The Corridor Action Strategy is really the I don't want to say it's the meat or most important part of the program, but it's the one I'm working on, so it's the one I'm going to give a little bit of emphasis on, and this is really the opportunity to look at that corridor from Seattle to Everett, to look at what's on the ground now, what are the values that each of these communities have, what are the common opportunities and common barriers that we see in some of these study areas or some of these transit nodes, what are some of the tools that are missing, maybe there's financing tools to be able to finance some of the infrastructure investments like new sidewalks or new street lighting or whatever it might be. Maybe there are financing tools to help finance the right type of affordable development, might be affordable development for seniors, might be affordable development development for moderate income families. Who knows? You know, what are the pieces that are missing? What are the tools that are missing that cities don't have to help make these places more successful? So we're working on that. The Regional Equity Network is a region-wide effort to bring together voices that are focused on social equity. So really looking at who is being included in decision-making. How can we make sure that voices that have been shut out or underrepresented in the past, or people or communities that have been disproportionately impacted by planning decisions in the past, how can we make sure they're at the table as well and overcome some of the barriers to civic engagement for them? So we have a whole effort around increased outreach, creating policy frameworks to incorporate those perspectives, and even a subgrant program that is funding nonprofits that are working on community engagement on the ground. And we have several rounds of funding available for groups that are doing that. The third is affordable housing strategy. This is something that we heard when we were putting the program together. And by affordable housing, what we really mean is housing affordability for all. So yes, we are talking about low income. We are also talking about 100% of area median income and just that whole range of affordability, and really thinking about how can we make sure that people at all different income levels have places to live in our region and have access to this transit investment. And the real obstacle that we've been hearing from people is that we don't have the tools. And by people, I mean cities. We don't have the tools. We don't have the financing mechanisms. We can't, you know, there isn't enough public subsidy to do all of it through subsidy, and we can't really subsidize moderate income housing. So how can we overcome some of these challenges? So the affordable housing strategy is really focused on tools. They're looking at land acquisition funds, because land prices are so high, and because what we've seen in the city of Seattle is that from the time it was announced where the light rail stations were going until the time it was built, so it was about a six-year period, housing prices, or the price of land, went up 600%. Outside of the study, and that was during the housing boom, so it's true that prices were going up anyway. Outside of, when you look at the rest of Southeast Seattle, it went up 153% or 155%. So 600% to 153%. So there's a locational aspect to that. So this land acquisition fund is looking at how can we help offset the price, how can we strategically come in at the right time, the right moment to buy up some of this land that otherwise might go skyrocket, and then we might not have access to it later. It's also looking at tools such as public surplus land. How can we better program land that is sold by public entities, local jurisdictions, transit agencies? How can we put some caveats on that sale to make sure that we're getting the right type of development, the right type of community benefits that we want out of that development? And then also looking at providing technical assistance to jurisdictions. And Go City of Shoreline, you are the one city so far that has reached out and accessed that program so far. And so we've got staff that's helping the City of Shoreline looking at the multifamily tax exemption program. So very glad that Shoreline's been taking advantage of that. But we do have staff that is dedicated to just working with local jurisdictions on figuring out what housing programs are available and how to best tailor them to the needs of your city. And then finally, demonstration projects in each corridor. There's one in each corridor. In the North Corridor, it's a demonstration project at Northgate, looking at the multimodal connections that will happen around that light rail station and the redevelopment of the King County Metro Park and Ride site that's there now into hopefully a mixed-use, mixed-income development at some point in the future. And really trying to rethink that whole area south of Northgate Mall into a more walkable, pedestrian-friendly transit, bikeable, nice place to hang out, as opposed to what it is now, which isn't quite that. We're also doing a similar project in south downtown Tacoma, looking at, and there's a lot of equity concerns, looking at the existing populations in the MLK and Hillside area, for those that are familiar with Tacoma. And then the third one is out in the Bell Red Corridor. We're developing an innovative visualization tool called Decision Commons, which allows you in real time to look at what planning scenarios might mean for your city, for your neighborhood, and allows you to put in inputs immediately, and inputs such as, we want certain carbon gas reductions, or we want a certain amount of sidewalks, or we want certain heights or not other heights, or we want certain traffic levels, and it can spit out in real time what that scenario would look like. So it's a really powerful tool, and we're very excited that it's being used to visualize what the redevelopment of the Bell Red Corridor would look like, and the city of Tacoma has just put in money as well to bring it to the South Downtown project there to visualize what redevelopment of the Dome District and the Brewery District in South Downtown Tacoma would look like. So we're excited about that and excited that it might be not proprietary, so something that other cities could access in the future as well. But corridor strategies, that's what I'm excited about because that's what I'm doing. So what is corridor strategies? It's about, you know, it's about looking at, you know, like I said, it's not looking at the parcel level. We're not coming into every single station and saying this is where this housing should go. This is where you should put a crosswalk. We don't have the resources to do that. And that's really the job of the local jurisdictions and communities and what you're going to be brainstorming about as soon as I stop talking. So what we're really doing is corridor planning where we're looking at what are the obstacles that exist throughout a corridor, what are the opportunities that exist, how can we make sure that for however many light rail stations we have, that every single one of them doesn't try to build a mall that's going to compete with every other one, or doesn't try to build, you know, the same exact office park. How can we be coordinated as a region along this corridor to make sure that we're not all stepping on each other's toes and competing with each other and that none of us succeed? It's about looking, you know, more holistically at the entire investment and increasing opportunities and hopefully prosperity for the communities all along that way. So we'll be what we'll come out with at the end of the day. It's an 18-month process, and very happy that Rachel is involved, and Paul is involved, and Donna is involved on the task force, and Robin McClellan from the City of Shoreline is also involved in our task force process. At the end of the day, we're going to have recommendations for the corridor. We're going to have recommendations for the Puget Sound Regional Council. We're going to have recommendations for private and nonprofit partners as well, and hopefully with those recommendations, we're going to have some meaningful tools to help help implement some of this work. So the corridor action strategies, I'm going to kind of blow through these. We're going to come out with an existing conditions report that talks about everything that's on the ground now. We're working on it now. We're going to do some public meetings. We're going to have actions and implementation agreements. Again, this is being informed by a stakeholder task force process and a variety of other public engagement, stakeholder input. The affordable housing strategy, similarly, and I'm going to really go through these fast because I already talked a lot about this stuff. They're looking at the property acquisition fund, tax increment financing, which is a complicated tool that could do really wonderful things if it was done right, and but we can't really do it in Washington State. I'll take questions about it later if people want to know more about that. But it's something that we're looking at as part of this, and then public surplus, underutilized land policy, and then providing technical assistance. The Regional Equity Network is trying to create that region-wide voice, trying to create a policy framework for including those voices at the table. It's distributing, administering a grant program to community-based organizations that are working on these issues. And that information, if you know community-based organizations, nonprofit organizations that are reaching out to underrepresented voices, and you know, we'd love to hear about it because those are the types of programs we're trying to invest in with this. And then finally, those catalyst demonstration projects that I mentioned, Northgate, Tacoma South Downtown, and University of Washington. So what does this all mean for communities in Shoreline? You know, that's kind of the bottom line. And, you know, where we're at right now is that we are pretty early in the process of this Growing Transit Communities Partnership. We're just about a year into a three-year grant program. Staff's only been on board for, I guess I've been here 7 months or 8 months, and so we're kind of early. We're just starting to collect data, so I don't have a lot of data to share with you tonight. I don't have recommendations to share with you tonight, so at this point I'm going to get a little bit off my normal script because we're not at the point that I'm about to talk about anyway. But what we're trying to do is, you know, think about and encourage jurisdictions to start thinking proactively about these station areas, and hopefully at the end of this process we'll have some meaningful direction to offer you as well. But first, to think about, you know, growth in Shoreline, what's been happening in Shoreline. And these are just pulled from the decennial census, and so if there's anything here that contradicts what your own perceptions of what's been happening in Shoreline is, let me know. But the population has basically stayed the same in the last 10 years, but the median age has gone up. The percentage of minority mixed race has increased. actually considerably by about 25%, from 22.5 to 28.6%. And this is what we're seeing throughout, particularly the 99 corridor. You look at cities like Linwood, for example, which is over a third minority now. And so, you know, thinking about those voices, and particularly the immigrant communities that are coming into those corridors where there's language barriers to being involved, and as that population increases, what are we doing to engage those communities to think about their perspective and their needs for the future? And then family households have decreased. While that, you know, decreasing 4% doesn't seem like very much, it's actually a 10% drop, and we're seeing that across the region. You know, what we're seeing is that we don't have as many two-parent with kids households. We're seeing a lot more retirees as the baby boomers are retiring, the empty nesters. We're seeing a whole lot more single households, or two adult no kid households, or single parent households. And those are the households that, in general, this is a general rule, but in general, are not as drawn to single-family households, and are looking in many, many times for those more walkable communities. These are folks that tend to be more transit dependent, either by choice or by necessity, and so these are different. And I guess with that, this would have been a good question for me at the beginning. How many people live in a single-family house? Does anyone live in multifamily housing? Has anyone ever lived in multifamily housing? College doesn't count. Okay, couple people. So the future growth in Shoreline is 5,000 new housing units by 2031. So that's what you've agreed to in the King County planning process. You've agreed to 5,000 new housing units. Is that going to be single-family housing? No. No, what it's going to be multifamily housing. So we've got a room right now of folks that do not live in multifamily housing that are thinking about the growth of the city of Shoreline when all of that growth is likely to be multifamily housing. So one piece that I would throw out there when we talk about how to plan for equitable transit communities in the city of Shoreline, one piece I would throw out there is that you need to include the people that are going to live in that type of housing. So either the people that live in that type of housing now, or you need to be doing the needs analysis to understand what the perspective and the desires of people living in multifamily housing is going to be. And along with that is 5,000 new jobs by 2031 as well. And so there's a challenge with this, a real challenge with this. And I live in a single-family house as well. I grew up in multifamily housing for much of my childhood. And there's this tension that exists that I sense in a lot of Seattle neighborhoods that are figuring out how to accommodate growth, to put growth on the arterials. And this is me kind of off script now, just talking about kind of my personal perspective a little bit on some of this. But I think it's important that that I'm trying to find a good positive way to say this. I grew up in two different apartment complexes, and the first one was at a very busy intersection in the city of Chicago. If anyone's familiar with Irving Park and Western, one very, very busy intersection, there was a gas station at the foot of my building, and there was nowhere for me to play outside. I couldn't ride my bike. It wasn't safe. The second place that we lived in, the second apartment building we lived in, was on a corner again, but in a quiet residential neighborhood. And there was grass in front of our house, and we even had a little garden in back, and there were trees. And we could play catch and football in the front yard, and I could ride my bike, and I had friends, and I could walk to school. So when we think about where people are going to live, I was part of a single parent household, two kids, and when we think about what people are going to want in multifamily housing, I think it's really important to think about the sense of place and the sense of safety that we're creating in these neighborhoods, and that while a lot of our development potential is going to be along arterials, because arterials are not the single family neighborhoods that we want to protect, those arterials are not always going to be conducive to creating the type of safe, equitable, livable neighborhoods where you would want to live, or where you would want your kids to live. And so I really urge you to think about that as you're planning for the station area planning work is to think about, you know, one of the challenges that you have here is that, and what that we have in the region is that a lot of our transit investments are happening along major arterials, and how do we make a sense of place there, and how do we make those places safe and livable? Now, in the city of Shoreline, you have a lot of advantages. You have these huge transit investments that are being made. You've got Rapid Ride, the bus rapid transit system that's going to be up and down 99. You've got two light rail stations that are coming to the I-5 corridor. So that's tremendous investment. That's a tremendous opportunity to catalyze this type of growth, this type of community. And you also have had a history, a particularly recent history of council leadership and of a supportive electorate that has been very forward-thinking and proactive about planning for the future of the community in a way that other communities haven't in our region. So looking at the Aurora Corridor project, for example, looking at the town center plan, looking at the sustainability strategy. But you still have this major challenge in that where these investments are happening on the Aurora Corridor and I-5 corridor are not necessarily places where you might not want to live right on that street. And so there's this challenge of thinking about how can you create a sense of place? Where does that place happen? It is most likely, in the case of Shoreline, not going to happen at the transit center itself. Because the transit center might be in the middle of the freeway. So what can you do to create a sense of place? What are the opportunities that might be a block off that transit center, a block away, to create a sense of place there? And a great example from just south of here is happening in the city of Seattle in the Bitter Lake Broadview neighborhood. They're undergoing a neighborhood planning process right now. And that, you know, there's a lot of multifamily housing there now. It's a very transit-dependent community, a lot of senior housing, a lot of low-income housing in that area. So while they are talking about rezoning, they are talking about more density and things like that, what they're really talking about, the main piece of what that process is about placemaking. It's how do we, you know, this neighborhood is anchored by Aurora Avenue, and Aurora Avenue down at 130th does not look like Aurora Avenue in Shoreline. You know, so it is not a pretty place with trees and safe crosswalks. You know, it's not, and it's not a center of vitality and life where people want to live. And so what they've realized and what's been the cornerstone of their plan is that it makes sense to put the new place, the there that we talk about, a block off on Linden, where there's a community center and where they need some more sidewalks, and you know they've identified the pieces that are missing, but that's the cornerstone of the plan, is creating that place. And so I really encourage, as you're thinking about station area planning for the city of Shoreline, is to think about these transit investments. You know, for the most part, you know where they are, or on I-5, there's still a little bit of question about where they're going to be exactly, but, you know, what is going to be that sense of place, that sense of community? And particularly with multifamily housing, you know, having the parks, having the open space, because they're not going to have the backyards. So, you know, having that piece of livability is just really, really important. So principles, when you're thinking about principles of station area planning, there's lots of great resources out there, so don't feel like you have to recreate the wheel. One that I really recommend is Station Area Planning, TOD 202, Reconnecting America and the Center for Transit Oriented Development. They have a whole series of books, TOD 101, 202, 301, 302, a whole bunch of them. One is just on station area planning. It's a really great resource. I suggest you check it out. The second one over here is Transit Oriented Communities, a Blueprint for Washington State. This is an advocacy book, and so with my formal PSRC hat on, I need to say this is not a PSRC document. We don't necessarily agree with everything in there, but with that hat off, I was the lead author on it. It was written by FutureWise. I think it's a great book. and it's got a lot of encourages you to think about metrics and performance metrics and what makes a successful community and what are the parking things that you need to consider and the open space and the design. And it's got a great chapter in there called Evidence that does the whole literature review on all of the data that's been out there that has linked this type of development, this type of community development, to just a whole host of those social, environmental, and economic opportunities that I talked about before. So it's a good read, in my humble opinion, and suggest check it out. And then finally, when you think about principles for station area planning, just and this is my last slide, Understanding the needs. So who are you planning for? Yes, you are planning for yourselves, possibly. You're planning for your kids. You're planning for your parents. You're planning for people that aren't here yet. You're planning for the needs of multifamily housing, which is not represented in this room. So I encourage you to look outside of this room and make sure that you are figuring out ways to reach out to people that aren't a part of the process quite yet, and make sure that they're included. But I also really encourage you, when you're doing this planning, think about yourself. Think about, if you lived there, what would you want, and what are the pieces, and make it personal, and make these places that you would live, that you would want your kids to live or your parents to live, and those, you know, put your heart into it, and then you'll end up with something good. Understanding the needs, what are their housing type, income level needs, very important. Who are you planning for, making sure you're being inclusive and innovative in your ways of outreach. And then finally, think about, just really encourage you to plan for people and plan for places. Don't plan for buildings. Don't plan for investments. If you plan for people and if you plan for places, the buildings, the investments, the infrastructure, the sidewalks, all of those things will follow. But start with the people. So with that, that's where you can find me. Happy to take any questions.
We need to use the mic so that the people that are going to be watching this later can hear the question.
Is that on? Okay. I was just wondering, on all the projections and stuff about housing, is that pretty current? And one of the things I'm thinking about is the economy, the way it's gone, and the number of families where kids are staying in the household much longer, and the aging populations where maybe the parents will be living with kids. And I know when I was living in Lake Tahoe, just with the affordable housing thing, we were working on getting it so they could put mother-in-law apartments in single-family neighborhoods. And so I don't know if that stuff would impact this much, but I didn't know what the thinking was along those lines.
So the housing target number, which was the 5,000 units for the city of Shoreline by 2031, those were adopted last year. So those are fairly current. And I think the important thing with the housing targets is that they are 20-year goals, and that's they think that far out because there is going to be fluctuation in the market and in the economy, and you're not going to see a linear pattern of a certain number of households or percentage of new households every single year. You're going to have these dips. And the expectation is that that's about how much growth the city of Shoreline has agreed to accommodate by 2031. Maybe it's going to happen by 2025. Maybe it's going to happen by 2035. But in general, that's the amount of growth. Now, what that growth looks like is still a question mark. And a mother-in-law unit is a new housing unit. So, you know, whether that's on the same site as a single family or not, that does count as a new unit. So thinking innovatively about ways that you can accommodate growth in new multifamily housing is an important piece of it, but also thinking about what is the possibility in single-family neighborhoods to have those mother-in-law units, to have backyard cottages, to have cottage dwelling instead on smaller lots is really important. And we've seen a lot of cities in the region, the city of Redmond, I know I was talking to someone beforehand about the city of Redmond implemented what they called an innovative housing program where they allowed cottage dwelling, backyard cottages or detached accessory dwelling units, and what was the other one? There was one other type of innovative, different housing type that they were allowing in their single family neighborhoods. And the real crux behind it was they just realized as a city that their kids couldn't afford to live there when they grew up and that their parents who were retiring couldn't afford to live there. And so while there was a big effort to protect the single family neighborhoods, as there is in just about every corner of our region, it was also just a very personal realization that this is about accommodating our community and our families. So that I think that is a real important part of the solution.
Thanks, Sarah. You obviously been doing this for a while. For the Joe average citizen, there's a lot of material in there. I'm not familiar with the Puget Sound Regional Council, and kind of what I gather is that somehow there were some people who saw some money and went and got it and then built an organization around it. So it's kind of a private entity that's publicly funded. So, okay, and you can help clarify that a little bit. And then I'll ask my second question if you can retain that. Is so kind of what this all boils down to is that there's decisions that are being made regardless of anything else, and by doing this effort, we're going to make better decisions. There's money that's going to be spent by this gentleman back here as an example, and we can use that money better by making efforts like this. I think that is that the bottom line concept. So those are my two questions.
So I apologize that I didn't introduce Puget Sound Regional Council properly. The Puget Sound Regional Council is a government agency. It's a four-county government agency, King County, Snohomish, Pierce, and Kitsap. It's been around in various iterations and different names for 40 years, about. But then in the early 90s was really repurposed around the Growth Management Act when that was enacted in 1991 as the regional agency that was responsible for planning at the multi-county level. And so PSRC, the Puget Sound Regional Council, is really responsible for thinking about the long-term land use and transportation and housing needs across those county boundaries and really looking at the growth of the whole region. And they develop multi-county planning policies that then the counties adopt and then cities adopt. And so it's sort of an umbrella system that is laid out in the Growth Management Act. So it's a government agency. But the important piece is that when the federal grant was made available, PSRC, as the regional agency that usually or that receives a lot of federal funding and funnels it to local jurisdictions, particularly transportation dollars, PSRC offered to house this effort, but it's not governed by PSRC. So when I put up that list of organizations and cities and everyone that's involved, it's a consortium of interests, and they are the ones that are governing this program, this three-year effort, this partnership. So it's housed at PSRC. I'm technically an employee of PSRC, but our process and our recommendations that the task force that Rachel, Donna, and Paul are all involved in answer to that whole consortium, all of those entities, those cities, those nonprofit organizations, all of those groups are governing this partnership. And at the core, your second question, the core is, you know, are we making the most of our investments, or are we spending money in a way that makes the most sense? I think that there's definitely that's part of it, is looking at, you know, we're spending a heck of a lot of money on these transit investments. Doesn't it make sense if we make sure people can access them and use them? But I think that that's sort of a, I don't want to say mercenary way to look at it, but I think that, and this might just be my own, like, I get real idealistic about and excited about urban places, but I think it's about we're going to grow in this region, and it's about making great places for people to live. I've taken transit all my life. I took the train to high school as a kid, and it's about you know, making sure that people of all different abilities and all different ages and all different sectors of life have access to these, not just this transit investment, but also have access to libraries and schools and all of the other pieces that come with it. So this is not, we are not planning out these transit investments as part of this process. We are really thinking about what do we need to put around these transit investments so that the people living there can have good lives.
Just briefly, I'm Paul Cohen. I'm the city contact on the stationary planning. I just want to clarify that even though Shoreline, the city of Shoreline, is not a part of the consortium umbrella group that Sarah pointed out to you, we are very much involved in the Growing Transit Communities Task Force and have the opportunity to join the consortium, but we haven't gotten there yet, made a decision yet. So I want to let you know you're being represented at this point. That's all.
And to be clear, to join the consortium, it's a long legal process of signing documents. It takes a long time. So I didn't mean to give the city of Shoreline too hard of a time about it. But other cities are joining, and but it has been just, you know, trickling in. But we are.
Read those documents.
Yes, that's a lengthy documents. But yes, on the city of Shoreline is very well represented on the North Corridor Task Force, and I'm very happy to have them involved. And some of our meetings are even here in this room. So thank you.
Yes, I'm quite excited about the new investment that's happening along Aurora and along the Link Light Rail. I'm from the Briarcrest neighborhood over on the other side of Shoreline, the Bothell Way 522 corridor, and I was wondering where these, it's certainly a transit corridor, though not with the new investment perhaps, the capital investment that you see on the other corridors. Where do these other transit corridors fit into the planning?
Great question. And I think that, you know, we are as excited as we were about this opportunity and looking at these three primary corridors in the region. They are three out of dozens and dozens of really important corridors. You look at ferries, you look at, you know, the 405 corridor, you look at, you know, we're looking at just a couple of the rapid ride stops. We're not looking at the whole rapid ride corridor down Aurora Avenue through Seattle. We're not going over to Ballard and West Seattle. You know, there are all these other transit investments that are being made that are really important to the region. And what we are doing and the way we're thinking about it is that this process is hopefully a first phase, and that we're going to have tools that are going to be available, hopefully financing tools, funding tools that are going to be available region-wide. But we're really hoping that this work will become institutionalized either at the Puget Sound Regional Council or through some other mechanism, and we'll be able to then look at some of these other corridors. One piece that we're working on is, you know, as I mentioned, partnership itself is not governed by PSRC. It's governed by this independent consortium. But that means that whatever comes out of the these task forces, whatever recommendations, is then going to be taken to the Puget Sound Regional Council and asked asking the Puget Sound Regional Council to adopt it as regional policy. And so when the PSRC does that, when they're updating their regional plans, there's going to be an opportunity to apply these lessons and apply these tools to other transit corridors in the region.
Okay, any more questions? Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for coming to speak with us about equitable transit communities, formerly known as transit-oriented development. Your enthusiasm for planning and transit and building places for people is really motivational. So thanks again for coming, and I hope... And we hope that her talk has motivated you guys to stay and do a little planning with us. This will be one of our first conversations that we're having with easels and boards. And the reason we want to start this conversation, our council's being asked to guide, to make some decisions about light rail station area planning already, even though it's not coming until 2023. So they need help from the public to develop what we're calling framework policies that will guide future decisions. So we just want to talk with you a bit about station area planning. On the back of your agenda tonight were some questions that we hope would get you thinking, get the conversation started. I'm here, I'm Rachel Markle with Planning and Community Development, and three other members of the Planning and Community Development staff are here to lead conversations. We have Paul Cohen, Miranda Redinger, and Steve Zaffron, and we're just going to be by these maps and hope, you know, you'll split up and join us and talk for a little while about what you learned, what you like, what you don't like, and take a look at those questions, if you will. And thank you all for coming.